You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Reports of civilian casualties are slowly emerging from Iraq. The British Guardian reported that vans or truckloads of civilians, specifically women and children, were found dead at the end of gunfire by the U.S. forces for possession of the bridge to Najaf in central Iraq. Lolan Hughlin Benjamin is in Baghdad monitoring the assault on Iraq for International Committee to the Red Cross. Benjamin originally went to Baghdad to report on the conditions in Iraq under economic sanctions. With the onset of war, his mission has changed to include reporting the effects of the war on the Iraqi citizens. Peace Watch spoke with Benjamin yesterday regarding the bombing of the Red Crescent Maternity Hospital earlier this week and other civilian casualties.
I know the premises very well, and immediately when the news was out, we went there with colleagues, because the International Red Cross, of course, works in close cooperation with the national societies of Red Cross and Red Crescent worldwide. We went there. The truth of the matter is, in that case, that the target were official buildings across the road from the Red Crescent premises. So the premises were not targeted immediately. They were damaged by indirect blow of the explosion, which was extremely powerful. It was a missile that virtually pulverized premises that were across. They just totally flattened out. So the blow of the explosion caused all the window panes in the IRCS building and the adjacent maternity to, of course, break down, and many of the hanging ceilings were damaged, and part of the walls were also damaged, and cars in the parking lot right in front were destroyed. This is the way it happened. The people who were wounded were in the street in front of the premises, because the premises were empty at the moment of the attack, and the maternity was not operating. Patients had been referred to other hospitals for fear that this part of the city was not safe, that it might come under shelling. And mercifully, we can confirm that there were no direct wounds inflicted to people in that maternity. The people who got in harm's way were actually in front of the premises.
Do you know how many... Do you have any figures as to how many civilians that were in front of the premises were injured or killed by this?
Well, we have had only this Reuters release about that, and the fact that some people were taken to hospital by the Red Crescent people. We have not had first-hand possibility to witness that ourselves. So we go by the release that has been put out. But no, our knowledge is that, mercifully, those premises were not busy at the moment of the explosion.
But I think it's important that you point out that this was not a direct hit. This was not targeted by the military. It was inadvertently affected by a nearby missile. Is that what you're saying?
It is right in the middle of the residential area, this remains to be said. But there were official buildings across the road, and these were targeted and totally flattened out by a missile attack. And, of course, these are very powerful weapons and are likely to cause damage in the surrounding area, definitely. But they were extremely well targeted. They destroyed exactly the buildings they were trying to hit.
There were no women or babies in this maternity hospital at the time.
No, it was not operating. People had been referred to other hospitals before.
Okay.
The intense conflict actually set on.
Can you tell us about a market that, two markets that have been reportedly bombed either directly or inadvertently over the last 2 weeks of this war? Are you familiar with those reports?
Yeah, these are reports that have caused a lot of controversy, of course. The fact that people have accustomed themselves to the background noise of bombs and try and go out to do some shopping. There's not much shopping to be done. By the way, most shops, practically 90% of the shops, are closed. The only ones who do open are street vendors who are selling fruit and vegetable on carts, and some local fruit and vegetable shops, and sometimes groceries, even though they don't have much to sell anymore, and bakeries. So the reason why people go out is actually really just to buy some fresh food. We fear that if the city ends up being totally besieged, there will no more be access to fresh food because the people from the countryside won't be able to bring in fruit and vegetable grown in the rural land next to Baghdad. Anyway, going back to those two cases, there were large crowds of people in front of those street vendors on those shopping streets. And when some projectiles hit there, of course, the casualties were high because there were a high concentration of people on a small space. But you find out in such cases that the people immediately next to the impact, well, first of all, they are killed, and those next to it suffer heavy wounds, and anybody who is within short distance suffer light wounds from shrapnels. And they just need treatment such as wound excisions from a surgeon. And this is a pattern that we have seen consistently in Baghdad over the past 2 weeks. The people we see in hospital, an average of about 100 people a day are taken to the hospitals in Baghdad. And this is a regular pattern we see. Like 10% of the people need very serious surgery and the rest need wound excision and they can be sent home within 2 or 3 days.
How would you characterize the level of civilian casualties?
Well, up until now in Baghdad, there has not been any ground attack. It has been air raids only, targeted air raids on official buildings, on buildings also such as telephone exchanges. You know that now we can't operate telephones in Baghdad anymore. More than half a dozen buildings of telephone exchanges in all residential areas of the cities have been totally flattened out by missiles. And, of course, people living in the vicinity are likely to come in harm's way. There have been definite cases in which purely private property has been hit. You have probably seen the pictures in the media. There are a number of private homes that have been totally destroyed by what has been termed in 91 collateral damage. So this is what we have seen in Baghdad for the past 2 weeks.
Lalan Huguenin Benjamin, the spokesperson for the International Committee for the Red Cross, speaking with us from Baghdad. A popular anti-war poster designed by Seymour Trust during the Vietnam War read, "War is good for business. Investor Sun." It's a sentiment echoed today by anti-war activists who have targeted businesses in the U.S. growing richer from contracts around the invasion of Iraq. Peace Watch spoke recently with Charles Pope, Washington, D.C. reporter for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, the newspaper, about some of the corporations receiving lucrative contracts for the rebuilding of Iraq.
Bechtel is in the running, is one of the finalists for the first big round of contracts to rebuild Iraq after hostilities end. That figures roughly $600 million to do a whole range of things from repair bridges and build roads and put schools back together and build the power grid back and hospitals and so forth. A subsidiary of Halliburton was awarded a contract by the Pentagon to put out fires at the oil fields, and that's sort of connected to the reconstruction, but Pentagon officials say that that was an environmental necessity that had to be taken care of right away, and that was why they awarded it on a no-bid basis. So the big contracts are yet to be let out.
So is it not that unusual that Halliburton or the subsidiary of Halliburton would actually receive a contract early on without a bidding process?
Well, it is a bit odd, and the administration officials who are overseeing this, it's the U.S. Agency for International Development primarily, say that this is a bit of an extraordinary event. And on one hand, they point out that a lot of these jobs are very specialized, and there are not a wide assortment of companies that are technically capable of doing the work. But critics say that there's not enough light being shed on the process. And not only that, the Europeans are upset because they believe, and the administration has basically said as much, that the main contracts, the prime contracts, will be awarded only to U.S. companies. And whether or not there's favoritism or not, I think the administration is having some problems from a perception standpoint, that people tend to, at least some people tend to think that's going on, and that may be a problem by itself.
Charles Pope, reporter for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Last Saturday, following an anti-war rally and march in Boston with tens of thousands of participants, a much smaller group of people heard international human rights attorney Michael Ratner, president of the New York City-based Center for Constitutional Rights, speak about the connections between civil rights in the U.S. and the war in Iraq.
When we fight for civil rights and civil liberties, we have to understand it's intimately related to the fight against what the United States is doing, whether you call it in Iraq today, in Central Asia, in the Philippines, all over the world. And to have a safer world here, we're going to have a safer world abroad. And a friend of mine put it yesterday when we were talking. I say war and civil liberties go together. You can't have civil liberties as long as you're fighting essentially what this country calls a permanent war around the world, a permanent war on terror, a current war against Iraq. He basically says you can't have empire in the world and democracy at home. So that's really fundamental to me in any of this discussion. The United States has basically departed in every respect from international law, not just with regard to the war in Iraq. You and I can probably all tick them off. You know, Kyoto, the climate accord, International Criminal Court, a Chemical Weapons Convention, the ABM, the Ballistic Missile Convention, every single piece of international law, now the Geneva Conventions. So really distanced itself completely from international law, believing that it's a superpower that can do whatever it wants in the world, that unlike, and I don't want to say unlike completely, because the Clinton administration obviously had some of both in it, that had some lip service and some real service to international law, and some saying, like Madeleine Albright, that we stand taller than anybody else and we can do what we want. But this administration has gone a lot farther than that. And we can just look, obviously, the war with Iraq, and I think it's, I don't have to go through it, but it's obvious that since the Second World War, there's only two ways you can go to war in the world. One is in self-defense. That means armed attack against the United States, or some people have stretched it to mean an imminent attack. The plane's coming over. It's about to be launched. That's one way you can go to war. The other way is if the Security Council gives you the authority because there's a threat to international peace and security. Obviously, they haven't given that authority. The arguments that the U.S. makes, you know, that they pieced together with 678, 687, and 1441, those are arguments that are not accepted by the majority of international lawyers in the world, nor in the United States. Any good lawyer can find a few little threads and piece together something, but there's no legitimacy to the war from a legal, there's no legitimacy from a moral, ethical, or other way. I think it's important to label the United States for what it is, which is an aggressor country that's committing essentially a crime against peace. So one of the big efforts that you've seen, I think, in this administration, one thing is the people picked up, such as those in the Taliban and others picked up in Afghanistan, taken to these centers, and others are picked up in the United States, picked up and held in a Navy brig, others like the immigrants picked up here, and again, very little or no rights of review. It's a major, major push against what we would have considered the fundamental right anyone in the world to have their detention reviewed by a court. So that's one big aspect of the attack. A second big aspect, I think, is the use of what the U.S. calls stress and duress. Stress and duress is, many people would call it either cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or torture. The U.S. acknowledges that it's using what it calls stress and duress on people that it's picked up that are in Bagram or that are in Diego Garcia. And what stress and duress is, according to the United States, and they don't agree with every bit of this description, but this is essentially what's come out through various people's admissions. They take people and they chain them to the roof or the ceiling for 16 hours at a time. They chain their feet down. They're naked. They take the temperature down to 10 degrees or up to 100 degrees. They don't feed them. And they keep them that way. Someone recently, for 16 out of 21 days, was kept in that position. That's considered, in my view, as a person who teaches international law and does a lot of work on what that is, that's torture. That is clearly torture. That's what the U.S. is basically doing in these places. And to the extent it's not doing what I might say is torture, It's doing a practice called rendering. Rendering is when you take a suspect who you don't actually want to beat the heck out of yourself, which is what the U.S. actually official said, and you render him or send him to a country that will. And the countries that they've named are Morocco, Egypt, and Jordan, where we have very close relations with intelligence services that carry out that kind of practice. So that doesn't make us less guilty of the torture. Under the torture convention, aiding and abetting torture in that respect is torture. While originally the president has said all of this stuff is going to apply to non-citizens in his military order on tribunals, they didn't realize at the time, well, non-citizens, those guys are the bad guys, and all of a sudden they got a guy who they claim is a terrorist who's a citizen, and so now what are they going to do? Well, they do the same thing they do to a non-citizen, and they put him into a military brig. The what they call Patriot Act II, which is the new act that has just been either the U.S. purposely, either the Bush administration purposely let it out there to see what the reaction would be, or somehow actually snuck it out. Its main provisions are really frightening. I'm Patriot Act I, which there's a lot more in, but if you look at some of the stuff in Patriot Act II, it's pretty scary stuff. One is, you know, a lot of these cities have what are called consent decrees with regard to what their police are allowed to spy on. We had one in New York until a few weeks ago. Each city, Seattle, Chicago, New York, signed consent decrees with their police department saying, you know, you can't just spy on somebody. You got to have some criminal element. You got to make a paper record, all kinds of things. Well, you know, obviously the FBI and the police departments don't like that. Patriot Act II says, I don't care about all these consent decrees in all these cities all over the country and what they've done to limit police spying. All of those are, as soon as this act passed, invalid. Basically, it says no federal court is allowed to restrict government spying. Second thing it does is it sets up a DNA database, not on terrorists, not on criminals, but on people our government suspects of terrorism. So in other words, it's not that you have to have committed anything, it's who the government suspects. So presumably, I guess if you're from one of 19 countries and you're a male between the ages of whatever ages they say, 19 and 32, they're going to put you in the DNA, which this whole idea that the government, what they're really doing now, and my friend Jules mentioned this yesterday, is they're basically, because if people are suspected of something, they're going to put them in jail. They're going to use preventive detention. If people are suspected of something, they're going to take their DNA. We put it on an international level. If Iraq is suspected at some point that it might use weapons of mass destruction that it doesn't even have, we'll attack it now. There's a certain parallel of advancing the line to, you know, basically suspicion by, it's uncheckable by any kind of court system or any kind of UN. It's just a suspicion of the executive.
International human rights attorney Michael Ratner, president of the New York City-based Center for Constitutional Rights. A soldier who saves a fellow soldier's life is often called a war hero. Now, the few who save the peace and prevent war are recognized as peacemakers, and very few of them are awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Yesterday, a silent vigil was held in front of the White House, led by Nobel Peace Prize laureate Moired Corrigan-McGuire. Peace Watch associate producer Angelique Chauffard was there and files this report.
It's April, one of the first really bright sunny days in the nation's capital. Unlike your typical peace march or nonviolent civil disobedience, there are just a few people standing quietly in a semicircle facing the White House, some wearing black. Little handmade coffins are arranged in the middle. Doll babies rest in children's play wagons as red fluids symbolizing blood drip down their faces and bodies. A small lady with a strong presence breaks the silence and begins to pray. She leads the silent vigil while holding a sign that says, "We are sorry," for she believes that a nation that doesn't repent is destined to repeat the same errors. Moired Corrigan-McGuire is a Peace Nobel laureate from Belfast, Ireland, who joins other religious and human rights leaders in connecting spiritually with the millions of peace activists around the country and the world in hope of achieving peace and ending the war in Iraq. I spoke with Moired Corrigan-McGuire about her initiation into the peace movement that led her to being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1976.
Well, I come from Belfast in the north of Ireland, and in 1976, in the height of our troubles, there was a clash between the Irish Republican Army and the British Army, and three of my sister's young children were all killed. And Andrew was only 6 weeks old, and John was 2.5. Joanne was 8, and my sister Anne was dangerously ill. So at that stage, I came out with another Betty Williams and another guy, Kieran McKeown, and we started a peace movement. And for that movement, in 76, myself and Betty were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
Maguire expressed that during the war in Ireland, the American administration and Tony Blair both encouraged dialogue as a means to resolve the conflicts in her homeland. Now she finds that the dialogue process has been absent in this war.
Well, in Northern Ireland, we were helped by our, go through our peace process by the American administration, who encouraged us as the Northern Irish people to talk, to have dialogue, to have all-inclusive dialogue. And we are very grateful for that help. I mean, Senator Mitchell came to Northern Ireland over 100 times in order to help bring together the parties in conflict. You encouraged us to solve our problems through dialogue, and we want you to solve the Iraqi situation through dialogue. You see, American administration says that it's tried all the ways to solve the problem before going to war, but that is not true. That's wrong, because the American administration never spoke to the Iraqi administration on any level, at any time, on anything whatsoever.
Since Ash Wednesday, members of religious groups have gathered in front of the White House in silent vigil and plan to continue every Wednesday until Easter. Scott Wright, a member of a Catholic group, spoke of the little black coffins and what they symbolize.
The coffins symbolize the death of Iraqi civilians, whose numbers we don't know, but in some cases whose names we do, in part because there are at least 20 U.S. citizens who, through Voices in the Wilderness, have remained in Baghdad, and each day are filing stories, filing pictures, visiting the marketplaces that were bombed, visiting the hospitals where the wounded children have been taken.
Leslie Arena, another participant of the silent vigil, articulates her feelings about the war.
My name's Leslie Arena, and I am here representing the parents of those military men who are 20% African American soldiers, who sailors and Marines, etc., who are in Iraq. For me, this invasion is like when they talk about Saddam Hussein being an awful guy. It's like finding out that your neighbor, who lives in a row house across the street, is beating his wife. So you rush across the street, you set the house on fire, you kill the children, a woman runs out, and you expect her to hug and kiss you. I think that's just nuts.
I read a piece that you did on the internet. You spoke of how the economic sanction is actually a weapon of mass destruction, sort of like a new kind of bomb. And I want to quote you. You said that new kind of bomb, more cruel than weapons. Weapons kill quickly. Economic sanctions condemn the innocent to a slow, painful death. Talk more about that.
Well, when we were in Baghdad, we went to a school to visit some of the little children. And we were taken there by Kathy Kelly, who is a young American working for Voices in the Wilderness. And the children love Kathy. She's gone many times into the children, bringing medicine and food and toys. But this little girl, Joanne, she was only about 9 or 10, and she stood up and she said to us that the economic sanctions are like a nuclear bomb, but more cruel, because with a bomb you die quickly. With the sanctions, the children are dying slowly and painfully. And she herself who made this comparison, a child who knew that these sanctions were killing their people.
What sort of suggestion would you have for people who want to get involved, who want to make a difference? How can they start?
Well, I think you start in your own heart. You know, really, we couldn't go to war if millions of us didn't support it, either by learning the art of war or by supporting war through our attacks, or by building machines I mean, 1/6 in America is in the military-industrial complex. America is a militarized society. This country is bound in chains to the military-industrial complex, and that is tragic because this country is primarily and allegedly a Christian country. But we're out of our roots because Jesus said, love your enemy and do not kill, and yet we are one of the most militarized and cruel when we go out to fight wars. So I really think we started in our own heart by learning nonviolence, by teaching nonviolence in our home to our children, by building communities of what Martin Luther King called the beloved community, by really challenging our governments to uphold international law, and by challenging them to demilitarize. There are a lot of steps, but we start with ourselves. Well, I've almost been inspired by the American peace activists. I mean, down through the years, people like Dorothy Day, who worked for social justice, who worked for the poor and the Burricans. And even when in New York, when I went with 40 people to be arrested, one of the people with me was a blind woman who said that she was coming out for peace and for justice. When we were arrested here in Washington a few days ago, to be arrested with 60 people who are putting themselves out there to say they have to follow their conscience, because your conscience comes first. So I'm very hopeful for the future when there are people like that. But I think now, between now and Easter, I would like to encourage people to pray for peace, to fast for peace, to come out for peace, to take a stand for peace. Easter week on Ash Wednesday, we hope to have Nobelists coming to Washington, peace counselors, faith people from different faith traditions, to have a huge stand and optional civil disobedience, so that people will stand to say, war has had its day.
Nobel Peace Prize laureate Moiréad Corrigan-McGuire, that piece was produced by Angelique Chauffard. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Chauffard. We had production assistance from Adel Hamid of KPFA, David Goodman of the Boston Community Reporters Project, Benta Berkman, Mike Aloney, Eddie Becker, and Keith Chalgian. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit Pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.